Hail, hail, welcome to Celtic Underground podcast number 58. My name's Eddie Pearson and you're listening to a Celtic fan podcast produced by CelticUnderground.net. This week I'm joined by Charlie Tully Jr., son of the legendary Celtic player from the 1950s. Myself and Charlie discuss his father's career, signing for Celtic, his early days, some of the highlights, some of the lowlights, and his time after he leaves the club. I was very, very grateful for the work of the Belfast Celtic Society in helping me get this set up, and I will give you a wee link to their website at the other end. Strongly recommend you check it out. It's an excellent, excellent website and really a great testament to a once great club. I hope you enjoy this. I've had a great time chatting with Charlie here, and I'm very, very grateful for him for taking the time. Speak to you on the other end. I'm now joined by Charles Patrick Tully Jr. Hail, hail to you, Charlie.
Yes, how are you? Thank you.
Charlie, we normally start these podcasts by establishing your Celtic credentials, so I've got a feeling I'll probably know what your favourite player was, but what was the first Celtic game you attended, and who was your favourite player as a boy?
Well, I suppose, to be honest with you, I've been very young when my dad was at Celtic. My recollection of that, to be quite frank with you, is probably fairly limited. No problem about my favourite Celtic player, because obviously I'm going to be totally biased in that context. It has to be Charles Patrick himself. But I suppose the early games would have been when I was probably 9 or 10 years of age. Now, in terms of exact recollection, that, to be quite honest with you, is difficult, because if it doesn't sound daft, I'm now 59 years of age, but the reality is that when my father died in 1971, at age 47, very suddenly as it was, really I learnt more about my father from that period on in my life than I had before, if that doesn't sound daft. My recollections early on are very clear about living in Glasgow, coming home to Belfast every summer in what would have been the close season to visit grandparents and other relatives. I would be quite clear about my schooling and little snippets perhaps about having a famous dad, but you know, they wouldn't have been sort of they wouldn't have been overbearing at that age and stage, because I suppose the awareness, to be quite frank with you, was maybe limited.
Sure. So your father was born in Belfast in 1924.
He was born on the 11th of July. He used to joke that it was the 12th of July, and you'll maybe understand that in the Northern Ireland context, because the 12th of July is the day upon which the Orange Men hold their parades.
Sure, it's well known over this side of the water as well, trust me.
So I think he enjoyed the possibility that the great Charles Patrick could have been born on the 12th.
What was his life like in those days? Was he born into relative comfort, or was it a tough upbringing he had?
When I say grassroots, working class, that would not be an understatement. Very large family, didn't have anything in terms of materialism. But then, to be fair, you can well imagine, and at that particular time, 1924, there were a lot of families in the same boat. So, you know, some people would say that was the norm or run of the mill for the time.
Sure.
And I suppose, to be quite truthful with you, that would be the case.
And what was he? Was he one of 12?
That's correct, yeah.
All right. So it's big family, yeah.
Big family. You can imagine the situation. Hand-me-down clothes and shoes, which I know for a fact did happen. But again, I mean, not making a big issue of that, but that was, as I say, probably fairly normal for the time.
And at what age was he spotted by Belfast Celtic?
Well, from what I can recollect, if you take it back, he was born at 24. He signed for Glasgow Celtic in about 48.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take it then that he was actually he was actually 24 when he signed for Glasgow Celtic, which was probably, in modern day terms, slightly old. But he had been at Belfast Celtic certainly for since he was probably, I'm going to guess, 17 or 18. He was out on loan with them for a couple of seasons because when he did sign from fairly young, you know, he obviously didn't make the first team right away.
Mm-hmm.
I think the truth is that he was a fairly frail stature, not particularly athletic in any shape or fashion, but obviously a bit of a live wire with the ball and his sort of tricks at that early stage. And I think the feeling was that in the early days he was one for the future for them. Mm-hmm. And that proved to be the case.
How well developed was the league in those days for Belfast Celtic to play in?
Belfast Celtic were probably certainly one of the leading lights in Irish league football. Most of the honours of that era were shared between Linfield and Belfast Celtic, and that was a great, if you like, local old firm rivalry, Belfast Celtic and Linfield. So they would have shared most of the honours over that particular period.
And was it a decent level of football?
It was a decent level of football. You've got to bear in mind that it was part-time football. You can well imagine that, again, for the era, there was little or no money at it. But in saying that, a lot of the players of the time, both from Celtic and Linfield, would have progressed on to English and Scottish football, particularly the ones that were outstanding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was a manager in particular that made a big impact upon him, was there not?
There was. Lish, as he was called, Scott, or Alicia Scott,
mm-hmm.
who was formerly, as I understand it, a Liverpool and Ireland goalkeeper. I think he played with Liverpool until he was 40 years of age, which was pretty good going even in those days, as it would be now,
sure.
even for a keeper.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he came to Belfast Celtic, and I think from Lish's arrival, he certainly engineered quite a lot of success. He had his own style of management, which was probably different and maybe a wee bit ahead of the times. You know, he was a reasonably strict disciplinarian. He liked players to train and work at their game, and there's no two ways about it. He and my dad had a few bits of turbulence, let's say. At the time.
Really?
Yeah, well, I think you can imagine it. My dad, I think it's well documented. He was never a great trainer, even at Glasgow Celtic. He enjoyed playing the game, but I don't think he particularly liked having to train too hard, and that was the case even as a young boy. And occasionally, obviously, Lish would detect this, and Lish would maybe impose a couple of punishments. There is one in particular which is very well known where he got my father to paint the goalposts at Celtic Park when he was at Belfast Celtic, and my father got the bucket and the brush and painted one goal and basically left it at that, and Lish came along and said, "Now, you've only painted the one, you better get the other one done." And when he'd done the other one, Lish then came to him and said, "Right now, Charlie, that's where you have to put the ball on Saturday, in the back of the net." And, you know, that was one of the famous stories of mm-hmm. of that particular time.
Because it was an uncanny he came in, wasn't he? But was there never a problem in that regard with Belfast Celtic?
No, because the Belfast Celtic of the era were somewhat unique in Irish league football terms in that they played lads from any background, any religion, which was akin to the Glasgow Celtic ethos. Whereas the Linfield of the time would have played very few Catholics, perhaps akin to the Rangers of a certain era or period. So there was that sort of added space, if you like, to the rivalry. The other thing is that the two grounds were probably less than about a mile apart in Belfast. And again, I think that added to the local rivalry because a lot of the fans maybe worked together and would have met each other on and off. And, I mean, in those days, to be fair, in Irish league terms. They were getting gates of 25 and 30,000, which I've got to say to you, in today's terms, are unheard of.
And so it wasn't as if he was coming for backwater, really, when he came to Glasgow Celtic?
No, it wasn't, but I suppose the comparison's got to be made in that coming from part-time football at Belfast Celtic, and I mean, obviously, was probably a boyhood dream for him to play for Belfast Celtic in his own area and on his doorstep, and the great history and reputation they had. But to be then signed by the great Glasgow Celtic now, that instantly makes you pretty unique, I think, in anybody's book. Mm-hmm. There are very few, if any, have gone from the one Celtic to another. So I think that kind of elevated him literally overnight into the history books.
Just one of the many things that elevated him into the history books.
Absolutely, no doubt about that.
In 1948, when he signs for Glasgow Celtic, Celtic have just come off a terrible season where they've narrowly avoided relegation. Was it a gamble making that decision, or was it...
Well, I think there was probably an element of gamble with it. But in saying that, as I understand it, Celtic, as you rightly say, had been in the doldrums. I imagine there was quite a lot of unrest among the support, which would be typical of any big club. So I think, as I understand it, the history as it transpired, Charles Padley made an instant impression. Because I think with his flair and cheekiness, he lifted the Celtic support. I was just reading before you rang me tonight, September 48, which was probably in around his first Rangers game, that the great Willie Thornton came to him after the game and shook his hand and said, "Great game, son." So I think the Celtic support instantly took him to their hearts and vice versa. And you can well imagine the pride and the instant love that he would have had pulling that green and white striped jersey on for Glasgow Celtic, because, you know, this obviously must have been just literally maybe a boyhood dream, or even beyond that, to be honest.
And he comes and he starts against Morton, and I think his first Rangers game is a defeat, but then, what is it, about three games into his career, he has a spectacular game against Rangers.
Yes, that's correct. Yep. That's probably the game I was referring to. Yeah, I think that I would imagine that, you know, he was probably unique in many ways. I think his skill and his artistry, his tricks, his effect on the game, the fact that with his skills he could change a game, he could change it probably quickly, he could win you a game. And I think he was just something that hadn't been seen, and the timing was right. And certainly I know from his point of view, he just took to it like a duck to water, even though there would have been the added pressure of a bigger club, a bigger support, and, you know, the elevation of playing at that level.
And he moved for £8,000, which I can only assume must have been a fair amount of money in those days.
Well, we have often debated that. In fact, we were debating it at home here the other evening. And we were kind of saying to ourselves, I think the average labourer was earning about 10 quid a week, if he was lucky. And I imagine that to buy a house in Belfast there for Talksafe or Glasgow might have been £100. So if you, you know, equate that into the amount, it was a lot of money. But from Celtic's point of view, it probably wasn't a lot of money for what they ended up getting.
Did he become a well-off man because of it? Or
I honestly don't know that. Now, I won't tell you any lies on that. I don't know about signing on fee relevant to the time. I know he got a house when he went to Parkhead. We lived at Randolph Drive, Clarkston, mm-hmm. which I know has become, in modern day terms, probably a very affluent area of Glasgow. And it probably was then too. I think the house at the time cost about £3,000 or thereabouts. So, you know, in fairness, you're instantly living a different lifestyle. The pay wasn't great because it wasn't, to be fair, throughout football great, if you recall, again, the period. And but I don't think any of that mattered. My father was a man who, he didn't put a lot of value on money at any period in his life. And I would say getting by, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting it was a struggle by any means, but he was doing something he loved, and being at Celtic would have overridden any other downside, if there were any.
When we spoke prior to this interview, you mentioned that you had his original contract.
Yes, I had a contract. I have a contract he signed with Jimmy McGlory for 12 guineas a week. Funny enough, the contract was worded in such a way that during what they call the close season, when the season finished, there was no pay during that period. And just to relate a wee story to you that I picked up in later years, I met a man, a local man here, probably about 25 years ago in a business context, called Liam Flanagan. He was a goalkeeper at Belfast Celtic in my dad's time, and he also came to Glasgow Celtic, and I don't think there was very much of any money involved, but to cut a long story short, Liam didn't make the grade at Glasgow Celtic and came back to Belfast and became a very successful businessman where he owned a number of bookies and off licenses. But he related this story to me later in his life when he said, your dad and I travelled, Charlie, to Parkhead on the tram to training, and we're sitting on the tram and the tram conductor came down looking for the ticket for the fare, and your dad said to me, go ahead, Liam, you get it. And I said to your dad, Charlie, I haven't got it. You may get it. This was the fare. I think it was sixpence. And my father said to him, well, we'll hop off between stops because I haven't got the money. And we did. He says, we hopped off the stop before Parkhead. And he says, I heard the bus conductor say to a lady sitting there, to us, do you know who that is? He says, that's Tully hopping off there. He says, to go to train. And he says, he hasn't even got the tram fare. And Liam told me that was a true story.
Well, funny you should say that, because about three podcasts ago, I spoke with a guy called Tam Donnelly, who's a vice president of North American Celtic Supporters Federation. And he tells a story of travelling to a game with his dad and who she sits down next to him, but your dad. Yeah. And he has a wee chat with him and he gives him threepence and says, I'll score a goal for you today, son. And sure enough, he scored a goal for him and he says he gave him a wee wave while he was sitting on the wall. So he must have had the money that day. So there you are. So maybe that's why he couldn't afford the tram fare for the training on a Monday. They'd already given away to Tam Donnelly on a Saturday.
Well, that's true. But, you know, again, it highlights, to be fair, in general, and I think this was probably consistent of all the players of that year, there wasn't any big money. No matter whether you were Charlie Tully, Bobby Evans, Bertie Peacock, or anybody else, the reality was there wasn't money in football. It was all about, you know, the glory and the honour of playing for your team. You know, I think players of that era, and it's fairly often forgotten, particularly when you compare it to today, where, you know, let's be frank about it, very ordinary players who don't have a lot of skill can get 10, 15 or 20 grand a week.
If he was playing today, he'd be, what, a Ronaldo-type player? He would be a McGiddy or...?
Well, that's a good question, and it's an interesting question. It'd be interesting to know what people like your dad, who watched him and other people of that era, did. But anybody who ever did has said to me, what would he be worth today? It would be millions. And millions in the transfer market, and probably... And let's be frank about it, it doesn't take much to become a millionaire footballer today, does it? To be honest with you now. So yes, definitely, transfer value, millions, and I would think a millionaire player like so many others.
So he signs for the club, and almost instantly, there's what's can only be described as Tully Mania takes over. That I've read, I think I said to you before, I've read his book, Pass to You, which I happened to notice was going for £140 on eBay the other day, by the way. I also had a read of Charlie Tully, Celtic's Cheeky Chappie by Tom Campbell. And they both seem to give the impression that he was the first real celebrity footballer.
Do you know what? I would, in hindsight, I would agree with that. Because there are so many Charlie Tully stories. There were so many things he did. I mean, he had a series of articles, and I don't know what it was, even in Citizen or the Times of the day. The local, what you would call football paper in Glasgow, Tully Vision. There were so many Tully things. I mean, there were Tully cones and... you know, Tully drinks and this and that. And of course, the sort of folklore that built up around him, a lot of it which no doubt was self-perpetuated. Maybe a wee bit like, you know, the image making it to do today, only now it's refined and sophisticated with the like of the Beckhams and what have you that have followed, obviously, in recent times. I would say yes. I think it's fair to call him the first... Or one of the early celebrity footballers.
How did that impact upon your life as his boy? Were you aware of all this going on around you when you were growing up?
Honestly,
was it just your dad?
Well, I think when it was about Birmingham, that we left Glasgow when I was 10 years of age. So I leave Glasgow as a wee boy with a strong Glaswegian accent. Go to school in Belfast. The first day the teacher gets me up to read a book and everybody laughs because they can't understand me. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. But about 1966, my dad took me to Hampden. I think it was Celtic in Leeds. It was probably a European Cup game of the time. You know, the Battle of Britain kind of thing. And we're starting outside Hampden, queuing up to go in. And all of a sudden, quite literally, people recognised my father. In no time at all, we're engulfed and enclosed by what seemed, you know, about 100 people looking at autographs. Fathers of their day telling their wee boy, that's Cheeky Charlie Tully, one of the greatest. And they're all queuing up, and the police come along eventually and say, look, Charlie, sorry, we're going to have to break this up because we're going to have a bit of a problem here. And that registered in my head because I knew my father had finished playing then at that level. Mm-hmm. And yet here were all these people wanting his autograph, recognising him and wishing him well. And that certainly, that has stayed in my head now from that period.
But to you, it was just your dad went out to work and came home again.
Yeah, I know that sounds strange, but that's the reality of it.
Sure.
To me, he was my dad. And, you know, that as I say, at that particular stage, certainly was beginning to register. But up until 9 or 10, you know, it's pretty vague, albeit it would have been pleasant had it been different.
Sure. One of his books has got a picture of him meeting Danny Kaye, who apparently, yeah. I asked my father about it before come on. He says, what would happen with celebrities would come on and would do a sort of symbolic tossing of the coin and kickoff before a game. For a guy coming from Belfast with a poor background to be hobnobbing with Hollywood stars like Danny Kaye at the time.
Yeah, and I understand, I don't know if this is true or not, but apparently on the American tour 54, 55, I think they were just sealed in the whatever it was at the time, it would have been maybe the Queen Mary, the luxury liner to America. Mm-hmm. And there is a story going that apparently Bing Crosby was on the boat on the way over. And of course he was, you know, megastar at the time. And there is a story going about that he and my father did a bit of a song together because the other thing he loved to do, believe it or not, was to sing.
Well, do you know what? Just to interrupt you, I've got an MP3 of him singing a Celtic song, which I'm not sure if you've heard of, and I'm going to put it on the end of the podcast.
Oh, fantastic.
So I'll add that in.
Yeah, so he loves to sing, and by that I mean he sings in the bath, he sings in the bedroom, and this is honest now. Mm-hmm. Celtic songs... songs about himself. I can remember that from being a wee boy. Now that's just something he loved to do. And just interestingly enough, two of his brothers, Billy and Peter Tully, Billy's still alive, and Peter's unfortunately been unwell over recent years. They also loved to sing. So there was a wee bit of a show busy thing in them, and that was just a favourite pastime he had.
I take it, obviously, there wasn't the same sort of sense of paparazzi and intense media spotlight, but did your mother ever comment on being uncomfortable with it, or did she just take it as a matter of course?
No, let me tell you, my mother, Carrie, to be quite honest with you, hated life in Glasgow, simply because, if you can well imagine, my father was away a lot playing. He was training every other day, didn't play. They went on tour occasionally. They went abroad from time to time. So probably similar to any dad, or maybe more so then than now, he was away a lot. So my mother was there to her, Patricia and I, as it was at that time. Brian came along later. And I suppose it wasn't the same accommodation made as there would be now. Like when a celebrity or footballer comes to a club, they're made welcome, they're taken round, their wives are made to integrate into the team. There was none of that then. I think you were kind of left a bit on your own. So Carrie coming from Belfast, a young woman, married to Charlie, go from part-time Belfast Celtic to full-time Glasgow, that was a life change for her. Different city, didn't know anybody. And I suppose when you analyse it, maybe a difficult situation to deal with.
Sure, big change, big upheaval, and also to become that.
People going through that every summer. As soon as the football season was finished, Carrie got back to Belfast, back to see her mum and relatives, and back home, she called it, and she always deemed Belfast as home, where my father loved Glasgow, and indeed, even at the end of his reign at Parkhead, he was offered jobs in Scottish football, other management jobs with other clubs, and I think Kerry pressed to go home. Other than that, he would have stayed in Glasgow, because really Glasgow had become his first home.
One of the questions my dad wanted to know was, did he run a pub or did he own a pub in the Gorbals?
I've seen Pully's Bar, and I have a photograph of it. I'm not sure if it was just the name was loaned to it or whether he owned it, so I cannot comment on that. It wouldn't surprise me if he'd had some sort of involvement. And I suppose the other thing that you'd have to be aware of then, as is now, there would be a lot of genuine guys and a lot of maybe hangers-on, and a lot of people wanting to get a piece of your coattail just to maybe say, oh, Charlie and I are this, that and the other. But again, I can't qualify that, so I can't be just 100% on it. It wouldn't surprise me, because we went to Mass every Sunday in the Gorbals, and obviously the Gorbals being the Gorbals, Charlie was loved and held in high esteem by all and everyone.
That was a far trek for you for Clarkson to the Gorbals, was it? No. How did you get there?
I don't know. Again, I think it was just, you know, it might have been through a friend or colleague or, you know, something like that, relevant at the time, you know.
He seemed to enjoy playing against the Rangers. Would that be fair to say?
Of course he did, because that you know, I think, again, it was... It was the old firm rivalry, and I would say to this day, any Celtic player and vice versa likes playing against the main opposition. But yes, he did in particular. I don't know if that stemmed from his Belfast Celtic days with a Linfield rivalry, as previously referred to. But that was a big game of the day, and it still is. And I think the big crowds and the fact that. I think there is a saying that he always played to the gallery, and I think he wanted in those games and attempted to excel himself.
And in one game in particular, there was what became known as the Cox-Tully incident.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, there's been lots and lots written about this, as you know. It was certainly a big controversy of the time. But there seems to be two schools of thought. One was basically that, as I understand it, Cox was a fairly... uncompromising, tough Rangers player, quite physical. And I think that the feeling is that he basically took a kick at Charlie, and, you know, the crowd went daft. And as you know from that, then the referee seemed undecided and then basically decided that my father was as much to blame as Cox was. There was a potential near riot at the game at the time. There were all sorts of... inquiries by the SFA and the respective clubs and what have you. And I think at the end of it all, the conclusion was that my father was perhaps unfairly dealt with. He was made the scapegoat, or certainly made to be of equal responsibility, when in actual fact, I think certainly his feeling of it was that he was totally blameless.
I think the SFA inquiry suggested the referee had made an error, but never specified what the error was.
Correct. That's right, yep. And, I mean, it's mentioned in the book, as you know. I don't doubt that of its time, it was front page news for a long time afterwards. And again, I suppose it reinforced and highlighted the rivalry that we're talking about, and the fact that to get one over in the Rangers was something extra special.
But it's also the fact that in his own book, your father just kind of glosses over it as a bit of a nothing incident. I just, it's nothing, carry on, not to worry. Just a bit of handbags, I think, is what a modern parlance would be.
I think the feeling is that, I think he felt that it was blown out of proportion at the time. And, you know, I think, to be quite honest with you, I think the SFA felt that the easy way out for them was to make an example. And I think the decision was made unfairly that Charlie should be the prime example. Then again, you wonder the composition of the SFA at the time. I mean, you know, was there an anti-Celtic element within it? Or indeed, to take it a stage further, anti-Charlie Tully?
Would it be as specific as that? Would it be as if somebody wanted to take him down a peg or two? Was he too big for his boots?
I think there was an element of that. You know, when he was popular, obviously, with the Celtic Legions and some others, you can well imagine he was equally unpopular with some others.
Anybody in particular?
That's probably the biggest understatement of the night.
Well, let's be specific about one of those games in particular. 1957, the League Cup final. Did your father ever talk about that game?
Not particularly. This is the 7-1 game we're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, 57, right? It's still a record. 7-1. That is absolutely incredible. When you think of all the records, and they say the old cliche is records are there to be broken. That has never been broken. To be a member of that team and to have played in that game and to have won, and I don't say won, I think to be frank, they played Rangers off the park.
Mm-hmm.
There was probably never a more one-sided final. And I think a lot of the feeling is that when it was 7, it could have been double that. Now, you can imagine to be a member of that team, held in that esteem, and remembered to this day for that net alone, should you do nothing else. I think you're in the Celtic Hall of Fame for that.
Definitely. Was there any recollections in the house at the time? You know, did they come home that night and you couldn't believe it had happened, or did they all go out and celebrate? Or
I would imagine yes, the celebrations must have been mighty. I mean, there's no two ways about that. I'm referring back to the fact that I was 7 years of age then. Recollection isn't high, but I would say I could say this truthfully and honestly, knowing the man he was and some of the friends that he had at the time, particular one in particular who sadly passed away a year or two ago. I would have said they partied and celebrated something powerful. You can imagine it now, absolutely, no doubt about that.
Did they enjoy the high life?
Yes, there's a contradiction here actually, in terms of personality. He loved the adulation.
Mm-hmm.
He loved the fame. He loved the fans loving him. But of himself, he was a very shy man for the fame, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
In other words, I've been places with him in later life where he would know he would be recognised and he would know he would have people coming over to him. And he would kind of shy away from that a bit, as opposed to maybe promote it. Now, there's no doubt that during his playing career, he did promote himself big time, and you know, there was a whole era of that, as we've mentioned. But, you know, there was this kind of dual personality thing, I think, that he sometimes shunned it.
Was he putting on a performance? Did he become a different type of character for the benefit of the fans?
I'm convinced, yes. The emphasis was always there to put on a show. Mm-hmm. To parade all the tricks, to do something different when you can. The cheekiness in the park, it was as if he basically, I think, became a different kind of person with a jersey on and that. And that was limitless. It knew no bounds, truly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the nutmegging, the coming back and beating you again, the throwing the ball, the shy ball, as you call it, off the back of the boy when he turns, you know, all the trickery. Been a constant menace over 90 minutes and making you wish that you weren't playing against him. There was that devilment in him.
See, away from that, how did he enjoy his time? What was he into? Did he like to read? Did he go for walks?
Loved walks. Loved watching young lads playing football. Would have went, particularly when he finished playing himself, he'd pick up Irish League management, as you know,
mm-hmm.
with a couple of different clubs. He'd be out nearly every night around the local parks, doing a wee bit of scouting and watching boys play. The football thing, to be honest with you, was his first and all-time love. That never left him, ever.
In terms of some of the people he played with at that time or he was involved with at the club, reading the books, there was suggesting there was a definite sense of respect towards Kelly, the chairman. Did he have a good relationship with Kelly?
I would say, you know, from what I can gather and what I've read, like yourself, there was a good relationship with Kelly. I think, sadly, towards the end, and we referred to the book, and I know we can touch on that again, but I think the Desmond White was the instigator of getting rid of Charlie Tully. I know Charlie Tully thought that. Mm-hmm. Now, that might have been a personality thing. I think the book did contribute to it in no small way. But I suppose the other thing is that, you know, you have your peaks and troughs, and, you know, players get older, and the reality is that, you know, their effectiveness diminishes as time goes on. And I suppose, you know, even for the best of them, there's a time that you have to move on and go. But yes, I would say definitely he enjoyed, particularly in the early years, he enjoyed a good relationship with everyone at Celtic, from what I can gather.
You get the impression for the books his best friend was John McPhail.
Big John McPhail was a great buddy, a guy who Charlie would have respected, both as a player and off the park. Yeah, they were great friends. As I understand it, there were the two McPhails. There was John and Billy. He certainly would have been a player that he got on with great. Obviously, as you can imagine, in any team situation, there were guys that that you maybe got on with better than others, guys that you spent more time with or maybe, you know, socialised with a bit. And I mean, thinking of the players of the time, and indeed maybe one or two stories since, Bertie Peacock, obviously a fellow Northern Ireland player of the time, would have got on great with my dad. And funny enough, whenever Jock Steen died, Bertie rang me here to home and said, look, I'm going over to Big Jock's funeral. I think you should come over and represent your dad. Now, that was a tremendous thing for Bertie to do from my point of view. And we travelled over and attended the funeral, and indeed went to the reception they had afterwards in Glasgow in a big hotel, where it was basically the who's who of football. And what amazed me was the number of people of a later era and the same era who said to me, once I was introduced, Charlie, your dad, you know, what a legend, what a player. And that, again, you know, that again registered. Here were these guys, some of them household names in their own era, able to refer to Charlie, remember him, know him. Fantastic, you know. And I mean, to this day, this is something that I touch on. I see Paddy Crown wrote an autobiography recently that I looked at, and he said my dad was his favourite player. Mm-hmm. Billy Connolly and so many others, and so many other players at the time. Billy McNeil, who was a young boy at Parkhead then, Bertie all the same, who I've spoken to. And these are guys, when they say, you know, your dad was one of the greatest, you kind of have to think to yourself, well, if these guys are saying it, it must be true.
Anyone that I've spoke to that saw him play says he was the best. The very fact that he's still mentioned in song today.
You see, that's incredible for me, because, you know, we've talked about the rewards of the game or the lack of them, and we've talked about you know, footballers today being millionaires, but, you know, the greatest legacy that my dad has left us is the memories, the honours, and the fact that to this day he is still written about, sang about, and remembered by the Celtic support. I mean, you know, I don't think there's any greater honour that could be bestowed upon you that I'm aware of.
Well, one of the things that really struck me in Tom Campbell's book was the comment that Billy McNeil made about the letter he used to write to his father. And he would write regular letters. And there was one time where your dad took Billy McNeil, and there was another young player who I can't remember, which is terrible, but back to his house to talk about football, and they sat up half a night talking football, and Billy McNeil wrote a letter to his father telling him this. Do you want to finish that off?
When his father died, Billy went to clear out the dad's home, and obviously his dad had kept bits and pieces from Billy over the years, and the man sort of hoarded things like my dad did too, and Billy then related to us that he kept this letter, which Billy had mentioned he had stayed with my dad for a weekend because Carrie and my mum had come home to Belfast. And what an honour it was for young Billy then, only making his way at Parkhead and unknown and unheard of, to stay with the great Charles Patrick. And, you know, in addition to that, when my father died in July 71, Celtic wanted to send over the whole Celtic team as a mark of honour to my father. But you've got to bear in mind that July 71 was a hot and heavy period in historic terms in Northern Ireland, because we had the troubles at their peak. Mm-hmm. It's not that from a security point of view, quite frankly, it wouldn't be safe to do that. So Big Jock and Sean Fallon and Billy came over, and Billy said to me at the graveside, Charlie, if there's anything that we can do for you at any time. I was 21 years of age, the oldest of three, and I said to him, sort of basically unknowingly, what do you mean, Billy? And he said, well, look, let me put it to you, I guess. Celtic, your dad did everything for Celtic. He's a legend. And Celtic owe more to your father than what they could ever repay. So don't be afraid to ask. Now, as I've been on record as saying, we never did ask for anything, because, you know, we just felt that that wouldn't have been a thing to do. But I particularly remember and respect Billy to this day for that. And I've met him over the years on numerous occasions, even not so very long ago. And I always relate that story to him because he's just, I think, an absolute gentleman.
And recently appointed as club ambassador.
Well, what an ambassador. I mean, I have to say it, you know, a fantastic choice.
Mm-hmm. And I just thought that story really summed up for all the things that Billy McNeil achieved in his career. One of the things his dad thought was important enough to keep was the fact that he met your father. I think that's terrific. I think that says a lot about what general Celtic supporters would have considered to be important at that era, and your father was one of the most important things.
Fantastic. And I mean, you know, I can't emphasise enough what it meant to us at the time for Billy to actually not only be there, but to take the time to say that to me and to mean it. And you know, that meant the world to me and to the family at the time, to be quite honest with you.
Speaking of fathers, here's another question from Ada. my dad should actually be doing this interview rather than me, to be honest. What happened between your dad and Bobby Evans?
I don't know about that tremendously well, I've got to be honest with you. I mean, I know my father has often been quoted as saying that Bobby Evans was one of the best players he ever played with, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. I honestly don't know about, you know, the friction element, if you like. I'm not particularly well-versed in that one, to be honest. I mean, again, you have to say personalities. And they would have been two very different types of personality, I would imagine. And I think sometimes Charlie's personality didn't always rub the right way, maybe. And as a result of that, obviously, you will get confrontation and you will get disagreement. But beyond that, I can't speak with any authority now.
Again, in his book, he suggests a couple of comments in a column or something, because apparently he had a column that was Evening Citizen.
That's right. That was the Tully Vision, as it was called, that was referred to.
And he mentioned something about the back line or something, and Evans didn't like it, and they'd about handbags, and then it was all sorted. He spoke very highly of him in the book.
He did, yes, absolutely, and I think he meant what he said. I would honestly say, now, truthfully and honestly, I mean, Bobby Evans was a great player at the time. There's no two ways about that. I think I'm right in saying he was a captain of Scotland of the era. And I mean, you know, so I think the respect certainly would have been there. And again, I mean, right up to today, aren't you going to get these, as you call them, handbags? You're going to get these things. I think you see some of the stuff he wrote in Tully Vision was a bit tongue-in-cheek, to be quite frank with you. You know, he was maybe pushing his luck and chance in his arm then again. And I think maybe some of the things said were, maybe said to spark a bit of controversy. And so that would have been the devil in him.
Cheeky chappy.
Yeah, honestly, truly. Would have been very aware of what was being said now and the repercussions, but tongue-in-cheek would go ahead and say it.
Charlie, there can't be any discussion about your father without mentioning that game against Falkirk in the Scottish Cup tie. What happened?
Well, as I understand it, it was at Brookville, I think I was reading earlier tonight that there was 23,000 fans at the game. I think it was 1953. I think it was a Scottish Cup game. But that's a tight, compact ground, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. And he went to take a corner kick, and apparently first time round, he took the corner, and as you know, the ball ended up in the back of the net, but it was ruled that he had the ball outside the arc, That's what was said. So he took the ball, replaced it, made sure, and I think pointed to the linesman and the ref, thought it was inside the arc, in the old cheeky fashion, you know, do you want to take a kind of thing since I didn't get the first one right? Exact same thing again. And I mean, it must be hard to do once, but it must be nearly impossible to do twice. So there was Cheeky Charlie at his greatest. And there again, there's a poem about it. They've written about it, and they still talk about it. So that again was a magic moment.
And the thing about it was, that wasn't even a fluke, because I wasn't aware of this till I read up on it. He did it against England as well, at international level.
He did it against England. Alf Ramsey was the guy that marked him that day. And as I understand it, Alf Ramsey never got another England international cap after his performance. And Ramsey, of course, went on to be the great England manager, 66 World Cup winners. But he did it more than once. And there's no doubt about it. I mean, he had a tremendous skill and craft. You've got to bear in mind also, you know, you're talking about a very heavy football, not the sort of what you would nearly call plastic lightweight balls to play with at the minute, heavy boots, mm-hmm. heavy gear at the time. The world's changed completely in football terms to now. So that wouldn't have been an easy thing to do, to be quite honest with you. Just thinking about that, whenever my father finished playing and we were back in Belfast, we used to go down to what was the then Belfast Celtic ground, and you've got to bear in mind Belfast Celtic were out of football a lot of years by then. But the ground was still there. All I knew the ground, man, we'd get him to open it up on a Sunday morning, and myself and a lot of young lads and my father would have went down there to do a bit of playing about on the park. Beautiful pitch. You know, the ground was kept in immaculate condition, even though Celtic had been years out of football and nobody played there. We got the showers on, and while playing, you know, he would be sort of putting the ball through your legs and running past, even though he was slightly overweight and finished playing. Uh-huh. But he had this great thing called the scissors kick, which you're probably familiar with in terms of how you actually do it. But basically, you put one foot behind the other and you scissor kick the ball while it's in motion. And he could scissor kick this from the 18-yard line into the back of the net with a goalkeeper standing there. And of course, the first time he did it with an officer, we all said, flick. You're not do that again. And he could do that 6 and 7 times in a row. Put it in the back of the net in one corner, then the other, then the middle. And, you know, some of the lads of my age, I was still a young boy then, were saying, my God, how does he do that? So the skill was to blame. And, you know, all the other traits of his time were still there in later years. You know, he could still not make you and put it by you or get round you or, you know.
Sure. How many times did you actually go and see him?
I wouldn't have seen him a lot. I saw him in a couple of what you would call charity showbiz games towards the end of his career. Mm-hmm. I was always aware of his skill. I wouldn't have seen him a lot. See, he left Celtic about 19, I'm going to guess about 60. Mm-hmm. I was 10 then, and again, I wouldn't have... Again, you see, different year, different period. The kids nowadays are probably... The Beckham kids are going to see their dad from no age at all. That didn't happen then a lot. Not certainly from my point of view. So I probably missed a lot. But, you know, I wouldn't have seen him anything like what I should have done. So I would have missed out on a lot of that situation. But, I mean, I was very, very aware of what he could do, you know. I mean, I think the skill he had, he was born with it. I don't think you can train it into anybody. Sure. You've either got it or haven't. And he definitely, he had a natural talent and ability. So there's no two ways about that.
You started to mention there when he left about 1959. Something like that, when he was about
59, around that, yeah. Certainly broke his heart to leave, and to leave Glasgow again, because I think it's fair to say that Glasgow become a great life to him and a great place, a vibrant city, in footballing terms, a place to be, and to leave that, you were leaving behind a lot. Coming back to Belfast, which wasn't... didn't have the same football appeal by any stretch of the imagination, part-time mm-hmm. football. He actually went and played initially as a player manager for Cork Hibernians in what's known as the League of Ireland. And he got to a cup final with them, although they were beating the cup final. So in actual fact, just looking over his record, he played in an Irish League Cup final with Belfast Celtic and scored the winner before he signed for Glasgow Celtic. He played in Scottish Cup finals, obviously. He then played in the League of Ireland Cup final. So, you know, he probably did lots of things for his time that maybe few or no other players would ever do.
We kind of touched on his reasons for leaving. We've mentioned about the book that he'd written. And at the start of the book, he makes reference to the fact that he was the first Celtic player to ever write a biography.
Yes.
And when me spoke earlier, you seemed to suggest that this played a part.
My mother told me that in latter years. I'm looking at it tonight in front of me. 1958 apparently was the date it was written. He was still at Celtic then. 58 certainly would have been, in period terms, early for an autobiography. Autobiographies, I think, are written when you finish, generally, when you're at the very end of your career, not when you're sort of maybe halfway or three quarters of the way through it. So there was all that. The timing was probably wrong. It was controversial in content from many people's point of view. I think in particular the Celtic board at the time. I think it would have been better left until he was gone from Parkhead. And I think from that point of view, some people did take a dim view of it, and I don't think it helped his relationship at the time.
And you think that if it hadn't been for that, he would have got another season?
I do believe that he might have got another season or two, because it would have certainly been a lot of sympathy among some of the board for what he had done and what he had achieved, for the popularity and support. And yes, I do believe that the decision to write the book certainly shortened his Celtic career.
Celtic have a tendency to discard their heroes. Looking at your father's story, I think that's what seemed to have happened there as well. Would that be fair to say? Or?
I think that's very fair, yes, without trying to be controversial. I think that statement is true, and I think it's particularly true as far as Charles Patrick's concerned. I think he looking back on his career, he certainly gave them all he had and all he could, and loved the whole experience, particularly the relationship with the fans. Mm-hmm. And yes, I tend to think, this is going to sound maybe controversial from my own personal point of view, but I have never phoned anyone at Celtic Park for a ticket for a game. I have never asked for a favour. I have never asked for a signed programme or a ball or a jersey. And I have never phoned up and said, guess who I am? And I never would or will.
Has the club ever approached you or your family to say, can we help, or is there anything you need? Or
not that I'm aware of.
And I don't think you left the club as a particularly well-off man.
No. Well, in 1971, July, when he died suddenly, I can literally say he was penniless.
Really?
Yeah.
He was living with your gran, was he not?
Yeah. And working as a rep for a wine and whiskey company, and involved in part-time Irish league football as a manager, which he loved. Obviously had to work, let's be fair. At 47, you would expect to be working, earning a living. But, I think again it just emphasises, and I don't mean this in any bitter way, but I think sometimes it's easy for big clubs to forget players. And I think certainly in Celtic's instance, that happened. I emphasise not the support, because the support have always cherished and loved his memory. And that's something that quite frankly sustains us and keeps us going.
And that's one of the main reasons I was keen to get you on here today, because there are thousands.
That's why it's such a pleasure to be able to do this, because, he left us a tremendous legacy. We're millionaires in many different ways other than money. And a lot of those memories we cherish, and those experiences and achievements are priceless. And from my point of view, really all I'm trying to do is to keep the memory alive, because that's the most important thing to me.
And there's a couple of different ways you're doing that. What sort of things are you involved in at the moment?
Well, to be quite honest with you, for a number of years it's been my personal ambition to endeavour to in memory to him to create a website, because obviously this is one of the modern ways of getting the message out there, keeping the memory alive, letting people interact with you, communicate with you. And I'm actually now getting around to creating a Charles Patrick Tully website, which I would hope between now and the end of the year to have up and running. I'm getting some help on it from some friends and people, some of them involved with the Belfast Celtic Society. And we're going to attempt to create a website and to basically draw on all those memories and keep the name to the fore and keep it alive. And to be quite honest with you, if I can leave that behind me in my lifetime, I'll consider that a considerable achievement.
You mentioned the Belfast Celtic Society there. One of your father's ambitions was always to manage Belfast Celtic once again, but obviously Belfast Celtic was no more in 1949.
Well, I'm just touching on that. The Belfast Celtic Society, whose mission is basically to keep the memory of Belfast Celtic alive, I have to say that they have done more in recent years to keep my father's memory to the fore than Glasgow Celtic. But to be fair, to answer your question on Belfast Celtic, yes, certainly one of his lapping ambitions would have been to have managed to come back to Belfast and manage Belfast Celtic from the point of view of Belfast Celtic being reinvented and coming back into the Irish League. That was something he longed for and would love to have been involved in. Sadly, it didn't happen, and as you know, Celtic have not come back to this day. But the Belfast Celtic Society have done a tremendous job in educating the younger generation about the great achievements of Belfast Celtic, and indeed people like my father who you know are constantly remembered by him. And I think they've got to be given a great deal of admiration and support for their tremendous work in that direction. And obviously, I know this is part of the link up from that regarding the recent commemoration situation I had for my dad. So I've got a great deal of personal respect for them, and like to try and support in any way I can any functions or arrangements that they're having. I think Charles Patrick Tully will always, always be part of the history of Glasgow Celtic. I see a new updated Glasgow Celtic book. I saw it on a shelf in a shop in England last week on holiday, and I just went to the back of it to check under T for Tully, and there's about four separate insertions of information. So yet again, he's in there, and that's all that's important, isn't it, truthfully?
That's probably a really good point to finish on. And I think, if nothing else, what hopefully this will do is it'll have reinvigorated your father's memory in the eyes of a lot of Celtic supporters.
It's been a privilege to talk to you, and I've certainly enjoyed it. I've enjoyed the recollections of Cheeky Charlie, and it's been a wonderful opportunity for me to keep the name to the fore, as I say. And I thank you for your time. And, you know, I will keep you informed about the website, if I may.
Definitely.
In terms of the progress on the launch. And I would certainly hope to be able to launch it in both Belfast and Glasgow and come over and do it in person and do it via the Celtic Supporters Clubs, because obviously we'll be looking for whatever help and support we can get from a communication point of view. And I certainly look forward to talking to you again in the not-too-distant future.
Well, I guarantee you there'll be plenty of folk on the internet wanting to support you and help you. It's been an absolute honour to talk to you. Thank you very, very much for taking the time.
Well, it's all good night and God bless. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Charlie. As I said at the start, I was very grateful to the Belfast Celtic Society for getting this interview set up with Charlie Tully Jr. As you probably realised from that interview, he was a very humble man, and I hope what came across there was, it wasn't about self-promotion, it wasn't about him. The fact he just wanted to keep his father's memory alive, and a player of Charlie's undoubted talent should never be forgotten. Can I recommend that if you want to know more about Charlie Tully, you check out Charlie Tully, Celtic's Cheeky Chappie by Tom Campbell. I found it an invaluable resource and just a damn good read in the process of putting this interview together. You could also go looking for Pasta U on eBay, but £140 is probably a bit rich for most of us. I think I'm sure I got mine for £20. I don't know how I managed to do that. But that's a cracking read as well, and you really get the impression of a player with Gallus written all over him. Belfast Celtic Society can be found at www.belfastceltic.org. At the moment, they have Charlie Tully and 60th anniversary badges now available. The Charlie Tully badge in particular looks terrific. I'm going to put links up on the website to both of these images, and you should be able to find them there. There's also a Charlie Tully t-shirt, which you can order for a tenner. And in terms of the manager that we spoke about during the conversation with Charlie there, Alicia Scott, there's a very, very interesting article on Alicia Scott also on the website. So www.belfastceltic.org. And I mean no bones about it, the time that I spent talking to Charlie has given me a wee taste to find out a bit more about Belfast Celtic. It's a club that I was aware of, but not as ginned up in the history as I probably would like to be. And having done this, I've been looking at their site, and it's a fascinating story. It's a very sad story, fascinating story. And I think I'm probably going to delve into that a wee bit further in future podcasts. So hopefully that's something for you to look forward to. I received an email to say that Billy McNeil and Rob McLean will be at the Bean Scene in Clarkson at 2 p.m. on Sunday, this Sunday the 9th of August, for a charity event signing books to raise awareness of muscular dystrophy. I would recommend that if you're in the area, you pop in, and also try and pop into Bonnie's while you're there as well, because that's a cracking wee cafe and it really deserves a custom. You can contact the website at CelticUnderground@gmail.com. You can also put comments on the website, reply to anything you disagree with. If you would like to contribute to the website, you know you're very welcome to do so. CelticUnderground@gmail.com. As you probably detected from the start of last week's and most of this week's, we kind of, nearly, sort of, have got Skype organised. The Skype name is Celtic Underground. If you want to get in touch with me via Celtic Underground on Skype, you're welcome to do so. Any heavy breathers or anything like that that want to contact me and leave a message, I look forward to hearing from you. Celtic are playing Dynamo Moscow in the second leg tomorrow night, 5 o'clock kickoff. Here's hoping we can do the business. After thinking we'd get beat 2-1, I'm now in that daft zone where all logic is went out the window and you think, I think we're going to do this. I think we might just do this. We get a goal, who knows what can happen. Here's home, fingers crossed. I'm going to play out with Charlie Tully. So hopefully you enjoy this wee blast of Charlie Tully doing what his son says he used to enjoy, thinking about the Celtic. Hail, hail, we'll speak to you next week.
The greatest team, horrible. The South, they